WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mars is 35 million miles away, but it may soon be within our reach. President Bush has called for a manned landing on Mars within 30 years, and we've already landed unmanned spacecraft that sent back color photographs of the planet's surface. My guest, John Noble Wilford, is the author of the new book, Mars Beckons. It examines Mars' place in our space program and in our imaginations. Wilford is a science correspondent for the New York Times. He won a 1984 Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on space and science issues, and a 1987 Pulitzer as part of the Times team reporting on the Challenger disaster. He first wrote about Mars in 1965. Wilford told me what he thinks Mars has to offer us.
Well, in the long term, perhaps it will be a place where people will live. But that's getting far ahead of the story. In our lifetimes and in the immediate future, two things. One, we want to know more scientifically about Mars. Why does this planet, which in some ways is very similar to Earth, why did it have such a different history than Earth? And there are a lot of questions about, was there life ever on Mars? We've pretty much ruled out that there's no life on Mars now. But there's a strong possibility that there once was life, and we may be able to find evidence of that. But the scientific objectives on Mars can be pretty much accomplished through robotics. And over the next 10 or 20 years, I hope that there'll be more unmanned exploration of Mars, including perhaps bringing back a sample of Martian soil. In the longer run, I think eventually people are going to want to go to Mars. It's because Mars has been a fascinating place to us, because Mars is accessible, because the technology is evolving that would make it possible, and because there's some political reasons why we might want to, particularly in this post-Cold War era.
Now, more than any other planet, Mars has been the subject of speculation. Even in science fiction, the creatures from another planet are more often from Mars, I think, than any other planet. You've done a little bit of history on how we've viewed Mars and what kind of speculation people have had about Mars over the years. Why do you think Mars has been so much the focus of our imagination?
Well, it's an interesting story, and I suppose it begins way back with the Babylonians or even before. We could see Mars, and of all the objects in the sky, it seemed to be more different than anything else. It was very red, and when you think of something that's red, and all these other stars and objects are very cool, pale, this connotes life. This connotes something vibrant. Also, as we developed telescopes, began looking at Mars, we found that it's not only red, but that it has a number of similarities to Earth. It has bright white polar caps, and they seem to expand in the winter and contract in the summer. It also rotates in such a way that it's a day on Mars is roughly 24 hours, just as it is on Earth. Polar axis is tilted almost exactly the same way Earth is, which means you have four seasons on Mars just as you do on Earth. These similarities, the fact that you could see surface, and people began to see a lot of things on the surface that aren't there, such as the canals and oceans and things like that, but you could see a surface. Venus is a little bit closer than Mars, but that's completely shrouded in clouds. You can't see hard ground there.
Well, let's get back to Mars being red. Do we know now why Mars looks red?
Well, it not only looks red, it is red. It's mainly because it's rusty. The soil has a lot of iron oxide in it that's accumulated over time.
And it's the soil that makes the planet look red?
Yes, mm-hmm.
Now, you've said that the atmosphere around the planet is pink. Are we seeing that also?
Yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, that was one of the mild surprises when the Viking landers went to Mars in 1976. For the first time, we were on the surface of Mars, taking pictures, looking out at the horizon, and the sky wasn't blue. It was a sort of a salmon pink. And at first, even scientists were dismayed because they just assumed that the sky was going to be blue. And then they realized, well, why should all skies be blue? If the particulate matter from the soil is going to be red, then the reflective properties of that of those particles are going to cause a certain pinkishness in the sky.
John Noble Wilford is my guest, and he's a Pulitzer Prize-winning science correspondent for the New York Times and author of the new book, Mars Beckons. You said before that in some ways Mars is very similar to Earth, but it had a different history, and it ended up becoming a very different planet than our planet. What's the speculation about what those differences were in the history of Mars and Earth that account for Mars being probably a dead planet?
Well, I think one of the main differences between Mars and Earth is size and, of course, the distance from the sun. Mars is only about half as large as Earth, which means it has half the gravity of Earth, which is probably one of the factors that caused Mars to lose most of its atmosphere over time. It just couldn't hold on to its atmosphere, and it lost the with losing the atmosphere, it lost the running water. Now, the speculation is once they've now seen this evidence that there's been flowing water on Mars, sometimes in floods, apparently. Once they saw that, they began to speculate that perhaps in the first billion years, Mars, like Earth, is 4.5 billion years old. Perhaps in the first billion years on Mars, the atmosphere was much thicker, hence the planet was warmer than it is now, and you could have flowing water. And during that time, life could have evolved, because life evolved on Earth in the first billion years. It was a single-cell type life, and probably the same thing was happening on Mars. In the exploration of Mars in the future, both robotic and with humans, one of the objectives will undoubtedly be to look for evidence that there once was life on Mars, to look for fossils. There won't be fossils like dinosaur bones, but there will be some fossil evidence that they hope to find.
What would humans need to survive, even for a short amount of time, on Mars?
Well, first of all, they would need to take their own oxygen, because the atmosphere on Mars is very thin, about 1% of Earth's atmosphere, and it's almost totally carbon dioxide. So on early expeditions to Mars, you'll have to take your own oxygen with you, your own water. You would undoubtedly want to explore in the first missions, explore places where you could extract water from the soil. It's assumed that there is a permafrost underlying the surface of most of Mars. Of course, there are the polar caps, and in some of those there's water to be extracted. But if you can extract water, you can have that to drink, and you can also extract oxygen from the water.
What's the debate now about whether our explorations to Mars should be manned or unmanned?
That's always been a debate in our space program since the beginning, whether it is better to go the less risky robotic way or to use human beings. And I think from what I've learned from even the most ardent proponents of Mars exploration say you don't need to go to Mars with people, not now. What they would like to have is that be the ultimate goal, and that we continue and perhaps even accelerate robotic explorations of Mars as precursors to the ultimate manned mission to Mars. Also, what they would like to see is that while we are doing some more robotic exploration of Mars, we begin now or very soon to develop some of the technologies that would give us the capability to go to Mars with people when we so choose. Some of those capabilities that we need to be working on are larger rockets, boosters that would send up the components for the spacecraft that would be assembled then in Earth orbit, and from Earth orbit you would go out toward Mars. You would also want to have more experience dealing with life support systems for a long-duration flight. Remember, going to the moon and back, that was an 8-day expedition. Going to Mars is going to be something else again. It's about 9 to 11 months out to Mars. You'd want to stay a few months there, another 9 to 11 months coming back. So you're talking about a 2 to 3 year operation. So you have to be very sure of your life support systems. You also need to do more studies on the physiological and psychological effects of long-duration flight on human beings.
What are some of the scenarios for colonization of Mars?
Well, that's going far into the future. A lot of people see Mars as the one place in the solar system where, if we needed to or wanted to, human beings could eke out a living. You'd have to change the planet to some extent. You'd have to establish glassed-in domes where you could then create your own atmosphere and recycled life systems. You would want to eventually set up power plants and things like that, so you could remain for a long period of time. Eventually, you could even change the whole planet. That's called terraforming, making Mars Earth-like. That would involve, oddly enough, creating polluting their atmosphere so that you could have a warmer climate. In other words, just the thing that we don't want to happen on Earth, which is global warming, we would want to happen on Mars in order to establish a livable condition.
And what would the point be of colonizing Mars? So to have industry on the planet, to mine it and bring the materials back to Earth?
I don't know what the point would be. I think that's something that's going to be so far in the future that I only deal with it as a possibility that has to be recognized as one of the ultimate objectives of going to Mars, is to prepare the way should we feel that we need to colonize the place. You can think of a number of reasons why we might want to colonize it. We might want to... there might be overcrowding on Earth. People want to get away from Earth for some reason. You might just the pioneering spirit. Let's set up life somewhere else. There's no reason why Homo sapiens should be confined to one planet in the world, in the universe.
I wonder what impact Earth's environmental problems are having on the space program and on the designing of goals for the space program. And I'm thinking that this could work either way. Since the Earth's environment is in such jeopardy, this could spur us on to try to colonize other planets. On the other hand, I think it can make you really think twice about creating the kind of problems on other planets that we've created here.
Well, it's strange that the environmental movement, in a way, began with the space program. Once you began to see images of Earth as a small, single, fragile entity in the blackness of space, we began to appreciate viscerally what we already knew intellectually, is that Earth was a fragile place and that we needed to husband our resources. In time, that has caused people to think, well, why should we be spending all this money to travel elsewhere in the solar system when we need to be taking care of our own home planet? And that's a good argument. We need to be taking better care of our own home planet. On the other hand, you can, as you said, it makes us think, well, perhaps we should be exercising the option someday to leave Earth. Now, I'm not saying that this is what should be behind the thinking for going to Mars in the next 20, 30, 50 years, but I think that's definitely a possibility someday.
Space travel used to be called the race in space, and the race was between the United States and the Soviet Union. Now that the Cold War looks like it's over, do you expect to see more cooperation in space travel between the United States and the Soviet Union?
I would certainly hope so. Even before the end of the Cold War, as we're now proclaiming it, you were seeing a more openness on the part of the Soviet Union. Even before Gorbachev came to power, Soviet scientists were beginning to open up and draw in Western European scientists into their program because they needed the expertise and the technology of Western Europe. So I think that there will be a lot more in the future. And this is one reason I was interested in writing this book at this time, because I think we're seeing opportunities that didn't exist before to change the direction of our space program. Sputnik, 1957, people who were alive and understanding things back at that time were shocked to discover that the Soviet Union was as advanced as it was, and in the context, this seemed to be a threat to the United States. The Apollo project was not a scientific project to find out more about the moon. It was a response to the perceived Soviet threat, part of this Cold War atmosphere. Now, I think if we're going to have missions to Mars, both robotic and eventually human, we should be open to the possibility of having them be international operations because they're very expensive. And it would be better for nations to share that cost because, after all, it is humans going to Mars, not Russians or Americans or Germans. I think we would want to use every opportunity to bring the Soviet Union into the community of nations, welcome them there. And this is one way to involve them in the international community.
I wonder what the state of the space program in the Soviet Union is in this period of glasnost and perestroika and in a period of a very bad economy in the Soviet Union.
There's, for the first time, we are hearing opposition to spending on space in the Soviet Union. Sometimes the Soviet press is beginning to sound like the American press. Why are we spending this money on rockets when people don't have enough to eat? Because some of this may have been going on before, but it was behind closed doors and priorities were set without the benefit of input from the public opinion. So far, there has been no perceptible decrease in support for the space program in the Soviet Union. The Soviet space program has always been a very methodical undertaking. It's just sort of one step at a time, no giant leaps. So I think that they're geared to a more long-term basis. I don't see any change so far. As long as Mr. Gorbachev has control of things and doesn't feel pressured to cut back, I don't think there will be any cutbacks. Because, after all, this is one of the areas where the Soviet Union has shown over the years. Its technology, while not as sophisticated as the Western world's, still has been up to the challenge of doing some tremendous things in space.
How would you size up American popular support for space travel?
I think there's a great deal of popular support for space travel. We saw it after the Challenger accident in 86. If there was a time when people might have said, oh, cash it in, that we don't want to be doing this, it's too risky, it's too expensive, let's take care of other problems. They didn't respond that way. They said, we want a space program, and we want people in space. Now, when it gets down to the nitty-gritty, though, and it becomes a choice of this over that, very often the space program gets the hindmost. So there's no great hue and cry that we want a space program in America. It's not the way it was in the 60s when the imminent peril seemed to be moving things. Now things are very peaceful relative to the old Cold War days, so we don't feel the need for a space program, but I think we inwardly do feel a need for it. We need to feel that there are still frontiers to be challenged. We appreciate the technological benefits of the space program.
Some people have lost confidence in NASA because of the space shuttle disaster and more recently because of the problems with the Hubble Space Telescope. Have you lost confidence in NASA at all?
No, I haven't lost confidence in NASA. I think it's not a case of losing confidence in NASA, but being sorely disappointed. You remember that in the 60s and even the 70s, there was one thing in the United States that worked, that was achieving success after success, and that was NASA. NASA was almost synonymous with can-do and success. And here we find in the 80s that NASA, alas, is just like any other human institution. It's fallible. And so I think part of it is a disappointment. One more thing that is going wrong in this country. Now, I think another thing that is more real is that, like any other institution, NASA has probably suffered from some hardening of the arteries. It's an older institution. A lot of the fired-up people who ran it and worked there in the 60s have either left or retired or are about to retire. So it's probably not as vibrant a place. Also, in the 70s, there were so many cutbacks in the NASA program that they weren't attracting the bright young people in engineering and science. So I think all of these things have caught up with us. Now, most of the problems that we're seeing right now that have cropped up with the Hubble telescope, the shuttles, and other things are really a consequence of management decisions or flaws, if you will, back in the early 80s or in the 1970s. So it's not quite fair to jump to the conclusion that the present management of NASA is incompetent.
Would you ever want to travel in space yourself? Is this one of your fantasies?
Well, I applied for the Journalist in Space program for the shuttle and was on the short list when the accident occurred. So I was eager to go in space in the shuttle, and if the opportunity came, I would go right now. But I don't think the opportunity is going to come anytime soon. I doubt if I would want to go to Mars. That, you know, 3 years cooped up in a spaceship is a bit much.
Yeah, I find the average airplane flight difficult enough.
Right.
I want to thank you for talking with us about Mars. And my guest has been John Noble Wilford, the Pulitzer Prize-winning science correspondent for The New York Times, and his new book is called Mars Beckons. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.